This is Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istril and Darknotch. We'd like to thank Fantasy Flight Games for our hobby and their continued support, Drew Dallas at Card Game DB for our hosting, and the AGOT community as a whole for making this possible. Let us take you beyond the wall.
So welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. We're going to have an introduction segment, after which we're going to have an interview with Nate French, followed by an announcement for a tournament, and finally a conclusion with another very special announcement.
All right, well, this is episode 6, which is actually our 7th episode, because we did something neat last week.
Yeah, we did a chapter pack review, and I think we're going to continue to try to do this. Every time a chapter pack comes out, we're going to basically grab someone else, so you're not just hearing me and Alex's opinion on the pack, and quickly do a review of the whole pack. So I hope everyone enjoyed it.
In addition to that, so we mentioned in our last regular episode that we were going to have an upcoming interview with Nate French, and we were able to schedule that quite quickly. And we actually have that for you guys today. But before we jump into the actual episode, I just wanted to give you guys an idea of what we're aiming to do here. So the first is that, you know, a lot of people might want us to talk about when the next FAQ is coming out, changes in the current meta. But that's not an interview that you could go back in a year and get a lot out of. So we want to focus on a topic that, you know, a year or 2 years from now, you can come back to this episode and still get something relevant to the game. And there's another point, which is this is not the first time Nate has done an interview for a podcast.
Right. He did an interview with Two Champs and a Chump, and we wanted to make sure that the questions we were asking him in this interview were pretty different from the ones that they asked him in the other interview.
That interview is definitely worth checking out. There's a lot of the background about how he came into the game, some very neat insights into design, and that was the Two Champs and One Chump episode 100, their Ubersode, and he was their second guest on that. So, in fact, as a sort of precursor to listening to our interview, you should go back and listen to theirs, and then jump into this and savor it.
We're joined today by a very special guest. If you don't know who this is, you've been living under a rock, it's Nate French. So, Nate, why don't you tell us what you do at FFG?
Hi, everyone. I'm Nate French. I am my title is the Senior LCG Designer at Fantasy Flight Games. With Game of Thrones, I've been working on the game for the past 8 years, and I was a player of the game for about 3 years before that, right from the very start when it was a collectible card game. And at this point, I do a lot of kind of high-concept design, like plotting out big-picture ideas, what arcs and blocks are going to be about, and then I also run a lot of the playtesting and do kind of the development of the set after it has been designed. Damon does a lot of the kind of the trench work of once we have a concept workout, designing the individual cards and some of the mechanics for the sets, and then hands it off to me, and I take over and run the playtest and implement a lot of feedback. So I'm kind of involved at the front end, and then again, as the set moves towards its completion right now. I also work on pretty much all of our LCGs in some capacity or other. Worked on Call of Cthulhu, I'm next for Warhammer Invasion, Lord of the Rings, which was an original design of mine, Star Wars. I was involved with Netrunner, so it's kind of pretty much anything that has to do with any of our LCGs, that's what I do.
Wow, that's, I wouldn't say a mouthful, that's probably a lifeful.
Yeah.
I'm sure they keep you busy.
It's quite busy here.
What does the title of developer mean with regards to things like card art, seeing that they get printed, anything to do with, I don't know, distribution? Where are the limitations?
There's a couple delineations. They kind of blur together because, like I said, that I'm involved in different aspects of the process. The three main titles that get kind of thrown around in the LCG department are designer, developer, and producer. So the designer, This is kind of one of the first things that Eric Lang taught me when I first started learning the job regarding these roles. What he said was, it's the designer's job to make the game fun. It's the developer's job to make the game fair. So the designer is kind of crafting the experience and what the players are going to be excited about, what they're going to be engaged with, kind of the ideas, the mechanics, how it ties back to the theme, what different houses can and can't do, any kind of design statement goals for a set, like maybe there's a sense of the game is too fast right now, we need to slow it down, or the game is too slow right now, we need to speed it up, kind of those very high-level issues. That's another thing that I picked up from Eric very early. Eric was kind of my mentor when I first joined the company, so I learned a lot from him, and he kind of set me on the path with this game and kind of all the design that I do. He said that it's basically anybody can come up with individual cards and card abilities. It's more the designer's job not to just look at a design sheet and fill in 120 interesting cards on their own right. Designers more focused on designing and crafting a player experience. You want to focus on the big picture issues. You're building an environment. You're building sets of cards. You're building deck types. You're building interactions among the different player profiles, the metagame, not just among the houses, but among rush and combo and aggro and control, and also between like card type, there's balance issues and things to do there. Like characters are really important. Characters don't matter. It's all about plots and events. Different, very kind of high level clashes. That's what design's really focusing on. You're not just trying to come up with individual cards in a vacuum. Development, on the other hand, is once you have a kind of a blob of a finished product, development takes it and basically, they're working more on, they're looking at balance, that things actually work the way they're supposed to, that there's no one deck that is so obvious everyone's going to play it and the game's going to get really boring and no one wants to experiment with anything else. So development is a lot of kind of refinement. It's revision. There's a lot of times that something that the designer thought was going to be fun just isn't going to work, so you have to be able to identify when that's happening and take it out and replace it with something that is still true to the original vision but might be better suited to accomplish some of those tasks.
That sounds just amazing that you have this huge, you know, high-level concept. But how does the ideas and the way players play the cards in the actual current metagame influence the design process? Like, do you look at, you know, what's currently going on and say, oh, you know, maybe they're playing it the way you envisioned, or maybe a little bit differently, you say, okay, because of the way they're using these cards now, I have to adapt. Do you take that all into account as well?
Yes, it's kind of a constant adaption. Like, I think the one thing that you try to do is you try to always keep it, you try to keep it moving and progressing forward, and things, even if things are, everything's perfectly balanced and all the houses have different competitive builds, you just kind of let it sit there. People will get tired of it and it'll grow stale. So you're always kind of looking at what people are doing and thinking, okay, here's what they're doing now. How can we challenge them to do something different? How can we change the way they think about the game? Because that's kind of what the whole point of the living card game is that it's never solved. Anytime you get to a point where it starts to feel solved, then it's the design and development and playtest and kind of everybody who works on the game. It's your job to figure out, like, okay, what are people doing? Why are they doing it? And how can we get them to do something else? And sometimes it's by putting counters into the environment. Sometimes it's by leading with more with carrots. It's like, hey, come over here and do this thing. And eventually people start latching on to new ideas and new concepts. And two questions that I always like to ask players, either at tournaments or with playtesters, are what do you love about the game and what do you hate about the game? And those two questions, you'll get a lot of good feedback and inspiration for, like, here are the things they hate, and they'll also tell you why they hate it, and then you can start shifting the focus of design away from those things so that other aspects of the game start becoming more important. And if there's things they love, then you can that can get a little tricky because sometimes players love things because it is so dominant. So sometimes you can't always follow what people love. But if you dig a little bit, you'll find things that they love that aren't just, I love this because it makes it easy for the win. You'll find things that they actually, when they're engaged either on the positive side or the negative side of it, it's still interesting and fun and engaging. And those are the things you try to capture and bring out more in the game. And you do that through the card design.
So before we dig a little bit deeper into how that process happens, I want to jump back because you mentioned three roles, and the third one was that of a producer.
Okay.
And I was sort of wondering, what does that entail?
Okay, production is, it's kind of, I guess the way I like to think of it, it's kind of the non-creative aspect of the job. Producers do a lot of stuff like card layout, building cards. They're in charge of working with our production department, who works with our printers to kind of reviewing proofs, editing, anything that's kind of like the more technical end of things. That's where producers are involved. In a lot of cases, it's a case where it's one or two people kind of sharing the roles, but you'll see it more in like core sets. Different people will be assigned, like, this is the designer, this is the developer, this is the producer, and that's where you get a little bit more of that, those distinctions.
All right, well then maybe with the role of designer as you envisioned it, can you talk us through the design process a bit? So how does a card or mechanic first sort of jump into your mind and make its way eventually onto the table?
Yeah, absolutely. How do you get these ideas?
Okay, so at the very beginning of the design process, there is a lot of exploration going on, and one thing I like to work with is kind of a document. We call it a vision document, and it's basically you're writing down, almost making a pitch for a set of, like, here is schematically and conceptually what the set is about. We could take the King's Landing set as an example. That was actually the first set that I worked on kind of on my own as the designer. Like, up to that point, I had been working with Eric Lang a lot. Iron Throne Black and Five Kings edition of the Westeros set, we were working together in both design and development roles, and he was kind of gradually teaching me things and bringing me up to speed on the whole design process. So then King's Landing was the first set that he was not involved in at all. So I still remember kind of when, how exciting and also kind of daunting it was to go through that sense of, oh my God, I've got to design a set all by myself. And I remember a lot of times, like, I would, it's like, very clearly, I can remember a Saturday afternoon, woke up, had my coffee, and I went out to a bar, and I kind of sat there with a notebook, and I just started writing ideas of different concepts I wanted to explore, and the whole idea of, like, the shadow mechanic, and kind of that sense of cards you can invest in and bring them out at a later stage as a surprise. Because I think one thing, I wouldn't say universally, but a lot of players really like are surprise cards. Cards that, events that can change the table in an instant, or anything you can do in the game that is unexpected or kind of shocking to an opponent that can take him from a place where he thought he was in control and all of a sudden swing the tide back in the other direction. A good example of a card like that, I think, is Qyburn, who, when he comes out, you grab the guy from your opponent's dead pile, and all of a sudden they thought they were in a very secure position, and now they're looking at two new characters that they weren't expecting to face. So it's kind of that sense, and I was thinking, like, we always try to connect conceptual ideas and mechanical ideas, like, this is what the mechanic's going to work with, some sort of thematic tie-in back to Westeros. So with this whole idea, one thing that I really wanted to focus on was kind of the mystery and the just the whole environment of King's Landing. So it was like the two were married pretty early, and then it was a matter of figuring out how it's going to work. What is this going to work on all card types? There's only going to be characters. Coming up with a slush pile of different ideas that some of them you're going to use, some of them you're going to throw out, and also just going back to the source material and thinking about the setting and the environment you want to portray and making lists of these are characters that belong, these are locations that belong, these are the different ideas that are going to really bring out the setting that you're trying to explore and help promote that sense of story that you're also trying to capture with the game.
So you mentioned you called this a vision document. You said it's sort of like pitching it. Do you actually have to pitch it? Is there some part of the process, or is it pitching it to yourself?
It's a little bit of both. Like, for me personally, the vision deck is very important, just in the sense of I like having those goals on paper. And as you get into kind of the nitty-gritty of design and development and playtesting, there'll be a lot of, like, this card's not working. It'd be cool if you did this, or... And you start getting pulled in different directions, and having those very clear goals that are kind of set down in the vision deck up front can help you keep focus as different things that might be easy to do in the playtest. But if there's one card that comes up that is like, this card would be an easy fix, but is pulling it away from what you want the set to accomplish, maybe it's not the best thing to do with that card slot, and you need to work a little harder then and find something that is a good fit for the card slot, but it's also reinforcing your vision. There are also internal levels of approval at various stages, and the vision doc is one of them. For me, it's more of just getting those design goals down so that you have them to focus on as you're moving through the set.
And once you've gone through this whole process and you end up releasing the cards and people start playing them, do they tend to actually play them the way you envisioned them, the way you wrote them down in that vision document? Or do sometimes you just look at the way people are playing the cards and you're like, wow, that's completely crazy?
There's always times where people find new and unexpected uses of the cards. I think that's, in some ways, that's what makes it exciting. Like, one criteria I set for myself with, like, a lot of new concepts and new ideas is I like cards that challenge myself as a player to, like, this card seems cool, but I'm also a little uncomfortable with it, and I'm not 100% sure what people are going to end up doing with it. Like, you want to keep that little bit of open-endedness in there. You don't want to do pigeonhole design too much where it's, here's this card, and the card is created in a way that there's only one way that anybody could ever use it. I come from a writing background, and there's a strong sense that a story or a piece of writing is a jointly created experience between the author and the audience, and I kind of see gaming as a very similar thing. Like, the designer creates cards and tools, and then players pick them up, and they're the ones who complete the story. So it's great when we have players like John Bruno and Greg Atkinson and Corey Faherty who come up with these decks that you never would have imagined at the time, but they find ways to piece things together and make them work. That's the final step that keeps driving the game forward and keeping things evolving.
Yeah, I've occasionally, like in some other games that I've played, to rather than giving you the opportunity to play with things, it's more like an instruction manual. You know, they've given you exactly how you're supposed to build your deck, or they've given you exactly how you're supposed to play this.
And I like the
freedom that Thrones has in that particular aspect. Maybe to touch back, you mentioned King's Landing and the Shadows mechanic, and you said that the idea of twinning those two things was fairly early on, the sort of surprising with some mechanic involved in King's Landing. So did that mechanic start as cards face down outside of the play area? I mean, that seems like a great stretch from the existing game at the time.
Yeah, it was. There, I think probably because it was my first design, there was a real strong desire to try to create something new and something that hadn't been seen before and was kind of completely novel and revolutionary in the game, because there was nothing like Shadows before the King's Landing set. So to the extent that it was face-down cards, yes, it did start that way. It did evolve a lot in the process, and this is kind of, once we got into development and playtesting, I'm thinking back, some of the original implementations of Shadows, basically there was no number after the Shadows cost. Everything was, you paid two to put it into Shadows, and then you would pay one to bring it out of Shadows. So everything was basically S1. So that, it was simpler kind of from a rules presentation. Like, you didn't have to deal with the variable cost, but in terms of what you could and couldn't do with the design space, It was much narrower, whereas just being able to go down to S0 or up to S2, or in the case of some of the armies like S4, or I guess we have Littlefinger, who's S10 now, like just that, just a couple different stages of variability really allowed you to build shadows into your gold curve, whereas when they were all S1s, they were all competing with each other for the same slot in players' decks, and you couldn't scale the effects very well. So that was something that kind of came out as playtesters started working with the set, was like, we need a way to scale these cards better. Another problem with the early implementation or the early kind of design that I had created that we discovered in development was there was no limit. Like, you could basically bring cards out of shadows. I think initially it was any time as an action, and it was too free form. It really, like, it sounds cool when you first hear it, but once you actually start playing with it, it's basically saying, just start playing characters and bringing stuff into play whenever you need it. And there was, the game lost a lot of its structure and its narrative pacing. So we scaled back to start a phase, but even that, it was too easy to put a lot of cards into shadows, play some gold locations, Valar, then bring everything out of shadows all at once. And we needed to put some checks in that. So we eventually got to the point where it was one card at the beginning of each phase, the Shadows rules that everyone knows now, that it was kind of like those two changes really helped the mechanic come together and I think realize what it wanted to do from the start.
You mentioned that what it wanted to do from the start, you wanted to have cards that could sort of come out and be surprising. And we already had events, so, I mean, how are these supposed to be different from events in the initial vision?
There are a couple different things. Like, one is that that sense of, it's basically the meta sense of what a player says when he puts a card in shadows. It's like, I am doing something, but you don't know what I'm doing. And to me, that moment was very Game of Thronesy. It's like, I am plotting, I'm preparing something. You may have some idea of what it might be, but you don't know for sure, and you also don't know when I'm going to spring it on you. So that was
threatening. That's the feeling I get, is that someone has invested gold into something. There's a plan afoot.
Yep. That investment was another element of the design. That sense of, I'm doing something now that's going to pay off later, that sense of aiming towards the future. This is one of those things that always kind of goes into cycles where the game shifts back and forth between too strategic and too tactical. And this is kind of one of those design challenges where you keep moving it back and forth. And at the time, it was very much a throw out stuff on the table and just have more of it than your opponent, and always play for the present. Don't think too much about the future. And it was, the King's Landing cycle was in part trying to get people to think more about the long game and being able to plan for the future, to anticipate the Valar, to have something in reserve for after the Valar. That was part of what Shadows wanted to accomplish.
I want to sort of follow, because you mentioned that this is changing through playtesting because of certain specific iterations. So what is playtesting? Is that an internal process, an external process? Is that,
it's a little of both. There's a lot of people in the office who really love the game, and we do play quite a bit at lunch and after work and try new decks and talk about the new cards, probably in a lot of ways like you guys do, probably not quite on the same competitive level, because like that's another thing about being designers. Like, I used to be a decent player, but I think working more in design, I've really kind of fallen off the competitive scene a bit over the years. It's just, you start thinking about the game differently. When you're playing with design in mind, there's a lot of times you'll do things where it's like, well, I could do this, but it'll be more fun if I do this, or I just want to see what happens if I do this. And you shift your player habits from more of a, how can I make this as horrible as possible for my opponent, to what can I do that will make this game as interesting, or as kind of, you're almost like exploring more when you're playing a game instead of trying to win. I try to keep in touch with that competitive player by recruiting some of the top players in the game as playtesters and keeping a finger on the pulse of what they're doing, because they're really the ones who drive the game forward. So the question of what is playtesting, like, that's where the external playtest comes in, like the players who are playing it to win regionals and nationals and world. You want to know what they're doing, what they're being drawn to, what they're not, like what they consider unplayable, so that you can try to bolster it up and make it more interesting for players to explore. I think for the external job, there's two different levels of what I'm looking for from playtesters. One is that they're playing with the cards and exploring the cards and almost in like a scientific manner, testing things out. And this is working. This isn't working. This is too strong. It needs to be scaled down. This is too weak. It needs to be scaled up. And you're taking that feedback. That's kind of the balance type feedback. But then on a completely different way, I'm also looking at playtesters is kind of like a test audience where we're looking at how they're reacting to the cards. Like, what are they excited about? What are they having fun with? What are they building and looking at and playing without any prompting? These are the cards that when they're released, other players are going to react the same way to and really kind of spring to. But then there's also like, what cards are people not noticing, and or what are they only building because they're playtesters and they feel they have to give it a try, but they're not really excited about it. They don't want to play this deck. And why is it that they don't want to play this deck? Like, what is the deck hard to build? Is it hard to play? Is it just boring to play against? Or is it boring to pilot? Like, there's a lot of things that you could look for that aren't balance related, but it's more about just the experience of how these cards are going to come across to real players.
So Nate, FFG has some of the best artwork I've ever seen of a card game on their cards. Does that artwork influence the design process at all? Like, do you have that before and you see like a great picture and you say, wow, that's perfect for Rob Stark. I need to build a Rob Stark with this photo. Or is that something that comes afterwards in design?
We commission the art for the set usually after the cards are designed. Basically, once we get a draft design, about the time that it goes out to playtesting, we'll also commission the artwork, and ideally then by the time the set wraps up with playtesting, we also have the art. One thing that happens with this process is sometimes you get into a situation where you need to change a card because it's just not working in whatever capacity you want it to work as you go for playtesting, but you have this artwork already commissioned, so you're locked in conceptually with what this card can and can't do, and redesigning it, you still have to come up with an ability that stays true to the artwork, and it can be a lot of fun. Like, you're not just looking at a blank slate, you're looking at trying to design a card that fits a both mechanical need for the set, but also with this art piece that you have. But usually it's when we come up with a set, we will then commission the artwork specifically for the cards that we designed.
And are there sort of, I mean, obviously a certain character, you might describe them, but do you also keep that into account with, say, mechanics? Going back to the Shadows mechanics, if you're commissioning art, does the fact that the card is a Shadows card affect how you're going to commission the art?
Yeah, the Shadows cards are actually an interesting case, because if you look closely at them, you'll notice that both the graphic design template and, in a lot of cases, the art, are the colors are a bit muted, and they have a very shadowy feel to them. So we did, with the shadow mechanic, commission art with a very specific style in mind. A lot of darker, shadowy hues, mist, fog, more of a mysterious look to the cards was part of what we were doing with the shadow mechanic. That was actually one of the best examples of a place where the mechanical identity of a card worked and was reinforced by the artwork.
Another question I have is if you're involved at all in the translation process, because some of these rules can be complex, and I could see some issues when we translate them into other languages.
I'm only very peripherally involved in the translation process. It's usually once a set is done with all the playtesting and editing and proofreading and laid out and ready to go to print, then it is sent to translators, and a lot of the people who translate for us, they're basically in their respective countries, they're kind of the the local experts on the game. Like, if Game of Thrones is being translated into English, K-Tom would probably be the one translating it if you knew whatever language it was being translated from. So these people working on it know the game really well, and they'll occasionally have questions about, like, what's the specific intent of this effect here? We can translate it in one of two ways, and they'll explain what their two ways are, and then I'll be able to answer, like, okay, you got to go with B because of this. Another thing that's really nice about having these people translate the cards is it is an extra step where it's like they will occasionally catch rules issues that, and depending on where we are in the production process, we can correct it.
I have a brief example I heard from the Spanish meta about localization, which I think is a neat little anecdote, and it's not meant to highlight any mistakes. It's one of those things that happens in translation. So in English, we know that there are a lot of Greyjoy characters who are Ironborn, mm-hmm. and Finger Dance needles an Ironborn character to cancel an effect. This is all fine and dandy. Mm-hmm. In Spanish, Ironborn is translated as Son of Iron. Perfectly logical. Unfortunately, Asha is a daughter of Iron.
Okay, so the traits are different.
That's right. And so it's a completely logical way for them to have translated it when they decided that, but they just hadn't quite taken into account the fact that, for instance, Finger Dance would not work with Asha. I think locally they handle it in the way that they go, of course it works with Asha. I mean, I don't think it's a problem at the competitive scene. But I think it mm-hmm. illustrates nicely that translation is a very, very difficult process.
Yep.
I think one of the questions that I have to ask, so you mentioned it goes through this entire testing process and you're working with playtesters. So how do you know when you're done? Is that just you hit the time limit and eventually it has to go? Or is there a way you can go, okay, it just,
yes.
just clicked now?
That's an interesting question. It's probably different on every single project I've ever worked on, and that's been a lot of projects. They all kind of reach that sense of completion in different ways. Usually it's some combination in various capacities, 80-20, 60-30. In one sense, you do just run out of time and you get to a point where this set needs to go out the door if we're ever going to get it in front of people. Then there's also a sense of, and I think anyone who's ever worked creatively or written something knows this feeling when you've edited something a million times, but you kind of get a sense of that you're moving around in circles, and it's, I guess at a very basic level, it's that editing step where you find yourself putting commas back in that you took out earlier in the process, and it's kind of that with design, you get to a point on these cards where, like, you're right on the fence about them. It's like, oh, this guy could have an intrigue icon, or maybe that would be too good. So, like, you'll put it on, and then you'll go to lunch, and you'll come back, and you'll look at the card, and you'll take that intrigue icon off, and or maybe it's a trait. It's like, should this guy have the Ironborn trait or not? You keep going back and forth, and there's also a case of diminishing returns, where each time you do a pass on the set, you notice significant improvements, and then you get to the point where you do a pass, and as the set feels more or less the same as it did before, it's usually a good sign that, like, okay, maybe we are ready to move on to editing and proofreading and start wrapping this up.
So just coming off a set that we revisited a whole bunch of the old mechanics, how often do those old mechanics make a big deal in your design process? Like, every time, you know, you create a new set, you might use a shadow, put in another night watch, and then you kind of have to look back at those old mechanics and say, you know, will this break them? Will this just enhance them? How much of that type of consideration do you have to do with every set?
Again, this is going to be a where's the game at? What do we want to explore? What do we kind of want to phase out? The thing with old mechanics is that there are only so many cards that can go around, and you have to pick and choose the things that are going to get the most return and help create the best experience for the most players. There are some mechanics, like, there's some mechanics that some players want to see come back, but in hindsight, you come to a point where you get a sense that maybe the game's better off without this being too prominent in the competitive metagame. I think one example of a mechanic like that I was really thinking about quite a bit just the other day is the stalwart keyword. Stalwart's is one of those things, it's on a few cards, it's kind of interesting on a very fundamental level, but you can't really build a stalwart deck. And my general sense with the whole mechanic is that it's fundamentally flawed in the sense that it a game advances and becomes exciting. Basically, players want to see it change from round to round and turn to turn and moment to moment, even action to action. That sense of change and the game's going somewhere and progressing. And I think a deck where too much stalwart, where it was too easy to make it happen, would slow it down at both ends. One way the game changes by cards being removed from play and leaving the play area. Stalwart basically says that every time you remove this card, it's going to come back. And then another way the game changes is by new cards coming into the game, and that's through your draw engine. And Stalwart also slows that down. So kind of on both levels, what Stalwart's going to end up doing is slowing down the game. And that's really going to
be difficult to work around, I guess.
Yeah, it's cool in small doses, but if there was too much of it, with sometimes players do kind of, why don't they support Stalwart more? And this is the reason that if there was too much Stalwart in the environment, I think that the environment would seem kind of very sluggish and bogged down, and that wouldn't be good for the overall health of the game. So Stalwart is one of those mechanics that it's good in small doses, but too much would be a bad thing, in my opinion.
So, of mechanics that have been revisited, I do want to mention the shadows again, because that seems to be a theme here. So, you designed it, it changed through playtesting, it changed so on. It's been around for quite a long time, and you've released more Shadows cards. Have any of those been to change the way Shadows has been used, or is it just to keep splashing it and keep it, you know, keep it fresh?
I wouldn't say that there's ever been kind of a concerted effort to change the way Shadows have been used. Maybe to change who's using Shadows and why people are using Shadows. Like, I think early on, Shadows was used almost more in a splash manner, where a lot of people would use one or two of the better Shadows cards in their decks, and they almost did become kind of glorified events. Mm-hmm. Is like, here's the two or three Shadows cards that I'm going to use in my deck, and I'm just going to splash them in, but I'm not really going to focus on Shadows in any meaningful way. Part of what some of the evolution of Shadows tried to accomplish was make some of the more focused Shadow-type decks really come together, and in some ways, a lot of it was just giving houses that had some key pieces, like the Lani Tunnels or the Barath, Queen of Thorns.
Queen of Thorns is right.
Yeah. It was just kind of giving them more pieces that could fit into those puzzles and make those kind of centerpieces cards really emerge as viable archetypes for Shadows builds. Kingsguard was a lot about kind of revisiting old mechanics and giving them kind of new identities. A lot of what the Kingsguard was doing was to create a block of cards that would be jumping in and out of Shadows and kind of working together to create a lot of little combos and tricks and things you could do with the mechanic where you're engaging it, but it's also kind of more about that moving in and out of play and hit you and run back into Shadows and building a more focused deck on that aspect of moving in and out.
Yeah, I think that aspect of moving in and out is quite different from the original aspect of that sort of army amassing that he's invested resources in, and you don't know which cards they are. Because now, okay, I know that Preston and Jamie have gone back into Shadows.
Yep.
I know those two cards, but I still, you know, I have to watch for them coming, you know, from the sidelines at me. I think it is a very different feel.
Wasn't there always a card that kind of did that a shy character that came out of Shadows and you could target another Shadow character and put it in?
Well, that
yes.
Sirio.
Sirio was the other one. That.
Yeah, Sirio, and there was a location as well with the power challenges, I think.
Oh, Kingsguard Trail, something? Kingswood Trail?
Yep, I remember that card.
That's right.
Yeah, so there was a few cards that did it. I think they were less character based, though. It's very true that you know, you weren't hiding your armies or your men in the Shadows, and now you can see a lot more of that.
Yep.
All right. Well, I mean, that's basically talked us through the design process, sort of from first idea right up to the point where, you know, it's been published and in our hands. Once it's in our hands, how does that feed back into the design process?
I think the place where in a lot of ways where I'm most inspired with new ideas and getting a sense of what I want to do next in the game is at Gen Con and World Championships and regional events and just watching people play and talking to people before and after their games and after tournaments about what they're doing and what they want to do and what they're excited about. That's kind of really where you're inspired and you come up with that sense that kind of what you do on a basis matters to people and you want to take them somewhere new and somewhere that's even more exciting for the next big event. So that's always the goal, is to tap into what players are enjoying and give them more of that. And you really get the direct contact with it at the big events.
That's great. Thanks a lot, Nate.
I had a lot of fun. I think I learned a few things I hadn't quite thought about in the design process. Thank you so much for doing this with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Great interview. Tons of information. Thanks.
So I've been asked on behalf of Alvaro, who most of you know as Aoria, the 2013 World Joust Champion, to promote the Batalla por el Muro, or Battle for the Wall, which is this coming weekend. It's a huge tournament in probably the most competitive meta in the world. So check out the website, or check out his website at rocacasterly.com. That's rocacasterly.com.
So we really love doing this episode. It was so great to be able to talk with Nate and hear his opinion on so many different aspects of design. And we basically begged him to come back on the show again. And he did agree, but with a condition, maybe a challenge. Right, Nate?
All they have to do is win a store championship or a regional or even a national event with one of the two new agendas coming out, Conquest or Defiance. And I guess contact you guys with the verification that they won this event.
So we'll have to set a couple of rules. I think we'll set it so that the first person to win with the agenda, a organized play event with more than six players, and because I'm always going to plug my own spreadsheet, that event will have to be reported in the annals of Castle Black, and then contact us, and we'll be able to get Nate back onto the show. Actually, maybe we could offer some sort of personal incentive, some sort of reason why an individual might want to do this
beyond just doing it
for the good of the community.
I can do something where I can basically take a field of question by the community or maybe a couple from a couple of different people if they pull it off and send them into you guys. But we will have to basically anything that someone wants to ask, I'd have to run by the marketing department so that they can verify whether or not it's something that I'd be allowed to talk about.
That's awesome. You heard it here, listeners. Win either Conquest or Defiance and get your shot at asking Nate a question.
And I think we're going to do it so that if you're the first one to win and let us know, you'll get on the show. And if you win that same weekend, you'll also get a chance to show up on the show. So it doesn't matter which time zone you're in. It'll be by weekend. Anyone who wins on the first weekend gets it.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.